Welcome, everybody. This is the Mises Academy class, Principles of Economics. This is Lecture 6 on Tariffs and Quotas, and this is the Spring 2012 edition of the course. So now looking at the first slide here that's giving an outline of what we're going to go over today. This is one of the, I would say, most important lessons for somebody to take away from an introductory course to economics, right? I mean, it's, in the grand scheme, it's not really all that important that you understand where money came from. I mean, that's kind of a neat thing to know, but whether the citizenry knows that or not doesn't really matter. But it's crucial that the general public understands the benefits of free trade and that they understand why using tariffs or quotas to create jobs is crazy. And so that's what we're going to focus on tonight. And this is, for whatever reason, this is one of the hardest things to get across in economics. I spent, I think, 3 lectures when I was teaching undergrad at Hillsdale College. I think I devoted 3 lectures, at least 2, and I think 3, to this issue of free trade. And I mean, economists have done all sorts of things to try to get this principle across. You know, there's all sorts of cute little, you know, parables, reductio ad absurdum type arguments to say, you know, taking the logic of the people who are for tariffs to its extreme, it would mean that, you can do all sorts of analogies to just try to drive home the point, and yet it just doesn't sink in. And like, for example, at Hillsdale, like I said, I spent 2 and maybe even 3 lectures going over this, just hammering it from every possible way. And then on the test that week, or for that material, and one of the short answers was asking how to compute a trade deficit. And like, in turn, you know, the numbers I chose, the U.S. had a such and such trade deficit with Japan, and one of the kids, you know, put down the right number and then said, "Sucks!" exclamation point. You know, like, there was no reason for him to say it. The point of it was just to see, do they know how to compute, you know, what does the term trade deficit mean? That was the point of the question. And then he just volunteered so I would know that he knew it was really bad if the U.S. had a trade deficit with Japan, when I had spent 3 lectures trying to get them to stop thinking like that. So for whatever reason, it's just really hard to think like an economist on this issue. And I should also say, the history of the status of free trade as an ideal or as a policy goal has changed somewhat. So it used to be the case that an economist, you know, if I were talking to the class on this, that I could say without fear of another economist contradicting me, I could say, this is the one area in terms of like policy prescriptions where just about every professional economist on planet Earth agrees that you know, free trade is the ideal here, and that reducing trade barriers will make all participating countries better off. You know, we'll shower benefits among all the participants if there's a deal to reduce trade barriers between various countries. And, you know, so it's not an issue of if you're a free market. I mean, obviously, if you're a free market, you're going to tend to be for free trade. But my point was, it's not limited to that. So even people, even economists who are for extensive government regulation of workplace safety, or, you know, who are really concerned about, you know, who want to have a graduated income tax, you know, that kind of stuff, who want to have generous social programs and, you know, subsidies to higher education because they think there's market failures, and research and development subsidies. You could believe all that stuff and also be for free trade, or at least that was the case 30 years ago, I think, that just the case for free trade was so overwhelming, and the harm of tariffs, I mean, tariffs were so stupid economically. They were just so inefficient, they were so counterproductive, that almost no professional economist would be for tariffs, and certainly would not recommend that the government get the power to start implementing them, because then the politicians would start doing all kinds of crazy stuff. That is not as true now as it used to be. There has been, in recent years, a resurgence of academic interest in theoretical models showing what they call an optimal tariff and the conditions under which that would be true. And there's just been this wave of people who are challenging the free trade orthodoxy. So now I can't as it would be wrong if I told you guys now that, oh, economists across the spectrum, whether you're an interventionist or a free market type person, endorse free trade as a policy ideal. But that's not as true today as it used to be. So anyway, I don't have enough of a feel for the profession to say how big is it. But anyway, it's still the case that this is not something that's unique to free market economists. That the case for free trade is pretty widespread, but it has come under assault lately, and there are a lot of so-called heterodox economists who would say, you know, don't believe the lies of these free trade people, that, you know, the cutting-edge theorists have shown that there's all sorts of false assumptions underlying the so-called case for free trade, and that if you learn the standard case for free trade in your principles class, it's because your professor is either ignorant or lying to you. There's more economists who are, you know, that's their job. They're professional economists with PhDs. There's more of them now that would say that kind of thing. Having said all that, I think they're wrong, of course, but let's get into the material. And the stuff I'm going to go over is pretty standard stuff, is what I'm trying to get across here. Okay, so mercantilism historically was a system. I mean, it was more a guide for government policy as opposed to a well thought out academic doctrine. Okay, so it's what motivated governments basically. This is what the classical economists destroyed. Because mercantilism, we could describe it as a beggar thy neighbor philosophy. Beggar thy neighbor is what mercantilism was. All right, so the irony here is that mercantilism, when you read about it and you read some of the thoughts of the people who would advise the various kings and stuff in this sort of pre-classical economist era, so like I'm thinking like the 1600s and the 1700s. If you looked at what was guiding government policies, it actually was fairly similar to what governments today do. The one main difference I think that you would see is that, my thing here, I'll say back then they wanted gold or silver. And today, it's jobs. Okay, but today's philosophy or government policy is animated by crude mercantilism, I would say. All right, so let me just make sure you're not getting lost, you understand what I mean. So back then, the idea was a successful nation would run what was called a favorable trade balance or trade surplus, right? So the trade wouldn't be balanced. It would be a favorable trade surplus, or they would have a favorable balance of trade, which meant it was in surplus. So the idea, and so how would you do that? What they meant is you would sell more stuff to other countries than the other countries would sell you. And so since everybody is, their currencies are ultimately tied to the precious metals, what that ends up meaning in practice is if you run a favorable balance of trade with the rest of the world, your country on net is accumulating gold or silver each year, right? Because ultimately, you know, when you say you sell more stuff than you buy from the rest of the world, the unit of measurement is ultimately money. And so it's like, whatever, ounces of gold or something, pounds of silver. Because if your country's selling, well, I'll get to this in a minute when I start talking about trade balances, but it's when we say, when we try to add up and say, well, gee, what are our exports or what are our imports, you obviously have to reduce them to a common unit of measurement. So I'm saying it's money. And so what that means then, if you're selling more than you're importing on net, your country is accumulating money. And so that idea was what Adam Smith attacked in his Wealth of Nations. And what Adam Smith was ultimately pointing out, and Adam Smith is one of the classical economists. So when I say here that this is what the classical economists destroyed, I have in mind people like Adam Smith, but also people like David Ricardo, David Hume, John Stuart Mill, so forth. Okay, so there was a lot that the classical economists had wrong in terms of economic theory. Like if you didn't know, and by the way, this stuff, I'm just kind of giving you historical context. I'm not going to quiz you on this. Adam Smith actually had a labor theory of value, and Karl Marx got his own labor theory of value from the classical economists. All right, so the labor theory of value is not a Marxist idea. It was actually something that the free market classical economists embraced. And that was one of the things that the later economists overturned. They no longer believe in a labor theory of value. Right? So in terms of their economic theories, there was a lot that the classical economists believed that a modern Austrian economist would say was totally wrong. But probably their single most important contribution to economics was the classical economists absolutely destroyed the intellectual foundation for the mercantilist system. And one of the ways Adam Smith did that is he pointed out that for the nation as a whole, the accumulation of money per se is useless. That's not what constitutes the wealth of nations. Right? So you can see the tie-in with the title of his famous book that came out in 1776. Right? That if you're advising the king of France, the proper goal should not be to structure incentives on your subjects so that they sell more stuff to the rest of the world than vice versa, so that France can constantly accumulate more gold and silver. Because ultimately, what does that do? That just pushes up prices in France in terms of gold or silver. It doesn't make France actually richer. The standard of living of the French is not higher because they have so many tons of gold located within the borders of France as opposed to a lower number. What makes France actually have a higher standard of living, which actually makes them wealthier in a true sense, is if their output of food is higher, or they, you know, people live in nicer homes, or they have more livestock or whatever. You get the idea. So that's one of the arguments Adam Smith and people like David Hume and so on used to start destroying the foundation of mercantilism. But my point here is that the philosophy of mercantilism, the thing they sought and what sort of made their doctrines popular, also explains government policies today that regulate trade or interfere with international trade. The one main difference is today there's more of and I think it's probably because different nations now have their own fiat currencies. I think that's one reason that that this particular component breaks down. Because like I say, the one difference is back then, I think the thing ultimately motivating them was they were thinking, oh, well, if, you know, if I'm an individual and I have more gold, I'm richer. So if I'm the king of France and I want France to be stronger, I want the nation to accumulate more gold than, you know, than England does. And that doesn't quite work, or it's not as obvious when you do it that way. Whereas nowadays, politicians will routinely, when talking to the public and will describe their policies, will think it's obvious that we want Americans to sell more goods abroad than we import from foreign producers, but they won't say because we want to accumulate dollars, because that doesn't really make sense, right? You know, I mean, the French, you know, it's hard for the layperson to understand exactly how does international trade work when the people in France use euros, or they used to use francs, and we use dollars. That's a little bit weird, whereas if we pictured everybody basically using gold, then it would make sense that, oh yeah, if we sell more to them than they sell from us, then we get some of their gold. But it's a little bit weird if we have a printing press, and especially if our dollar isn't tied to anything. Because then we say, well, wait a minute, why are we selling stuff to France to get more dollars? We can just print more dollars. So I think that's partly why nobody thinks in terms of, well, actually, they still do think of that. They'll say stupid things, silly things. My 7-year-old would chastise me and say, don't say stupid. They'll say silly things like, oh, we want to spend that money domestically and keep the money within our borders instead of sending it overseas. So you do see it partly, but typically nowadays when motivating an interventionist trade policy, people will say it's to protect or promote domestic employment. But other than that, the analogies are quite similar. And there, one other thing, let me just finish this last train of thought and move on here. This beggar thy neighbor aspect of it, what I mean is you can't have a world full of nations that each are successful at promoting mercantilism. With mercantilism, if one country wins, the other ones lose. Or if a few countries win, then the rest of them have to lose. It can't be that everybody is a winner under mercantilism. Because under mercantilism, the goal is to export more to your neighbors than you import from them. In the world as a whole, exports equal imports. It has to. That's just, you know, accounting identity. So it can't be the case that every single country exports more to its neighbors than vice versa. So the rulers on the international scene are all mercantilists, you're breeding conflict. It's a zero-sum game. And so this is something that Ludwig von Mises used to talk about a lot, and why he thought what he called liberalism, by which he meant classical liberalism, and its emphasis on free trade, why he thought that was the only lasting method for world peace. He was saying, in an interventionist world where people are animated by the ideas of mercantilism and more generally state intervention in the economy, everybody looks at every other country as a potential enemy, that every other government is a potential threat against your country's welfare, whereas under the classical liberal perspective, if you see the world from the eyes of somebody like Mises, you look at everybody else as a benefactor. Like, oh, I'm so glad there's other countries in the world where, because of comparative advantage and these other things, we can get goods more cheaply from them than we can produce it ourselves, and vice versa. So we're so glad these other people exist. It makes us richer. And so that's a much different mindset from thinking, oh my gosh, these other people might take our oil. Let's make sure, you know, we have a stronger military than they do. Otherwise, they might get their dirty mitts on our oil. Or, oh, there's some dupes over there with some money, with some gold coins in their pockets. Let's try to force them to buy our sweaters so we can get their gold coins. You know, that's a very militaristic, hostile attitude to have. And Mises was saying it's no coincidence that the totalitarian ideas of the 20th century went hand in hand with terrible world wars. He's just saying that was actually a rational outcome, that Nazi Germany, given its economic policies, had no choice but to start conquering its neighbors. And so on. I mean, so he wasn't excusing it. He wasn't saying it was therefore moral, but his point was, you're foolish if you think you can have a strong centralized economic state that totally runs the economy and yet have a peaceful international brotherhood of nations. He's saying you're fooling yourself. The only way you can have peace is if all the governments believe in free trade. Okay, let's move on here. I'm giving you guys lots of good background stuff, but let's get into the nuts and bolts of this. Also, since this is such a sort of everyday topic and it's hard to know what the stumbling block is, by all means, you know, post your questions in the Q&A, and I'll try to leave time at the end for that as well. Okay, so when we talk about trade deficit or surplus, for one thing, just these terms are loaded, and there are some economists that just would wish we wouldn't even use these terms, because right off the bat, you start talking about a trade deficit, that sounds like it's bad, and a trade surplus sounds good, because every, you know, deficit means you're short of something, surplus means you have more than you need, and so just these terms sort of load the argument in favor of interventionism. Let me say one thing before I forget here. I keep wanting to use this term, but I'm holding back. So there's this term called protectionism. All right, and what that is what nowadays we would use. So it really, I mean, mercantilism is not in vogue anymore officially, even though, you know, I would say, oh, those ideas are mercantilist, that's almost like a slur. Like, by me classifying them as mercantilism, I'm saying, give me a break. The classical economists blew that stuff up in the late 1700s, early 1800s. How obsolete are you? Whereas protectionism is a more modern thing, and that's probably a more accurate description of what governments nowadays do with trade policy when they're trying to promote employment. Because where the word comes from is to say they think they're protecting domestic jobs or a certain domestic industry by levying a tariff or a quota or some other trade barrier. Okay, so if I say protectionism or if I say protectionist legislation or something like that, that's what I'm talking about, that the government is interfering with international trade allegedly to protect the jobs of certain workers in your own country that they think would be threatened if we let these cheap imports come in. So we're going to protect those jobs by keeping out the cheap imports or by taxing them so they're not so cheap. Okay, so what I was saying, what jogged my memory there, is that just these very terms, trade deficit versus trade surplus, sort of load the deck in favor of the protectionist worldview. Because what would happen under protectionism, it would seem, at least at first glance, is that it would, by keeping out imports, it promotes a trade surplus. Whereas if you allow a bunch of imports, other things equal, the more imports there are, the more you're in a trade deficit. And since deficit sounds like a bad thing to be in and surplus sounds good, already you're sort of giving people the idea that it's better to export than to import. But be that as it may, it's unavoidable. This terminology is used all over the place. You got to know what these terms mean. So let's just make sure you get that. Do I get it into the textbook? I think I do in the textbook. Now I'm getting my books mixed up. I know I do it in the Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism. I can't remember if I do it in the lessons for the Economist. But technically there's a distinction between, and this is more advanced than needs to be the case for our purposes here, but just for you guys who are overachievers, and if you go read stuff on this in the blogosphere, a trade deficit is not the same thing as a current account deficit, so you might see people talk about that. And it just has to do with trade means the actual goods that are and technically services that are transacted, and is there more going one way than the other? Whereas a current account also includes, it means like you're spending more than you could from what you sell, and also what you earn on different investments. So I'll come back to that in a minute. Let's just do trade first. So a trade deficit, so you need to know what trade deficit and surplus are. The current account thing, I'll just come back to that in a couple minutes. I'm not going to quiz you guys on that stuff. That's just something to, if you want to see how this stuff gets really complicated when you really start digging into it. Okay, so what would a trade deficit or surplus mean? What we're saying is looking at goods and services that are actually traded between people who happen to live in different countries, you convert them all to the same unit of money, and then you just add them all up. So if the people in the United States collectively spend $900 million buying Toyotas from people in Japan, then that's one aspect of it. You're going to see my brilliant art skills. Okay. So what that really means is, however many Toyotas times dollars per Toyota equals 900 million. All right, so there's a certain physical number of Toyotas that are being purchased, and then what we do is we say, what does it mean to say 900 million? Well, it's obvious. It just means what's the price, technically the average price, then times how many. Okay, so you're looking at how many total dollars are spent by Americans on Toyotas, and so in a sense, that's like the saying, oh, there's $900 million worth of sales from Japan to the United States, and then at the same time, though, during the same, and it's also, you always have a certain unit of time involved. And so maybe there's a bunch of wheat. It doesn't look like wheat. Everyone knows that's wheat. It would be obvious. I could show that to anybody, and they would say, oh, that's wheat. Going to Japan, and let's say they spent $800 million on it. So given these numbers, we would say the U.S., if these were the only numbers, obviously there's all sorts of other things, but suppose this were it. These were the only transactions involving people in the United States and people in Japan, then we would say, the U.S. has a $100 million trade deficit with Japan because we are buying $100 million more of their stuff than they're buying of our stuff. So that's why it's a so-called trade deficit. Whereas the Japanese would say, oh, we have right now, or over the last year, whenever these numbers, whatever the period is for which these numbers are true, over the last 12 months, we've been running a $100 million surplus with the United States. So that's all these terms mean. Okay, so you have to know that. Now, again, the harder part for those of you who are overachievers, what current account means is, let's say American citizens years ago had invested some money buying stock in Japanese corporations, so they were shareholders, and then every year they would get dividend payments on that. And let's say every year, collectively, American stockholders got $100 million of dividend payments from Japanese corporations. And then they turned around and used that money to buy. Well, it wouldn't matter what they used it for. All right, and let's just say that's it. The Japanese didn't own any financial assets in the United States. Well, then the current account balance, or the current account would be balanced. There would be neither a deficit or a surplus. Because what would be happening technically, if you want to think of it like this, is the Japanese would be sending $800 million worth of Toyotas to pay for the wheat they were buying, and then they would send another $100 million of Toyotas as the dividend payments on the stock that the people in the U.S. owned. So you could have a trade deficit. The U.S. would still have a trade deficit, but its current account would be balanced with those numbers I just made up. Okay, so that's the distinction. So it gets a little bit tricky when you start realizing that there are, you could earn an income from assets that are located in another country. And so thus, it's like money's flowing into your country, even though goods weren't going the other way. Right, so in that sense, if you think about it, when the Japanese corporations are effectively sending $100 million in dividend payments across the ocean, there are no U.S. goods that have to go the other way to balance that out. That's just their earnings from their previous investment. And so so the Americans can get away with running a $100 million trade deficit, and they're not like digging themselves into a hole. They're staying balanced, as it were. So that's why in more modern discussions, especially with people who are kind of policy wonks, nowadays you actually won't see people talking so much about a trade deficit or surplus. You'll see them talking about a current account deficit or surplus, because that's actually the thing that's more relevant. Okay? But like I say, for this introductory class, that's a subtlety that's beyond what you need to know. If I just confused you, don't worry about it. Just think of it in terms of sending physical goods for money. One thing you might be confused about is to say, wait a minute, the Japanese use yen and the people in the United States use dollars, so why are we quoting things in the terms of the same currency? Well, we have to in order to make the comparison, right? You couldn't say, oh, they spent, $9 billion yen worth of Toyota. They bought 9 billion yen worth of Toyotas, and they sold $800 million worth of wheat. So what's the trade deficit or surplus? If you said that, we'd say, well, I don't know, because yen and dollars are different units. In order to compute the deficit or the surplus, you would have to convert one of them to the other thing's units. And so the way you do that in practice is you use the market exchange rate. So what I've done here is I've already done that step and not shown it to you. So by converting the Toyotas to a dollar amount, I've already taken into account the fact that the dollar trades against the yen at a certain ratio that's set in the foreign exchange markets. Okay. All right. Let me say one thing about this before moving on. So, like I say, first of all, I just want you to make sure you guys know what a trade deficit or surplus is so you can think about it. Now that we know what it is, my point is going to be it's kind of useless. It's an interesting little factoid about the world that should have really no basis on government policy at all. And the way that a lot of economists like to get this across to people who are new to this topic is to say, look, with as much justification, we could go around computing trade deficits and surpluses between individual U.S. states. We could say, uh-oh, is Texas running a trade deficit with Louisiana? Because we could compute it. We could look and say, during the year 2011, add up all the goods and services that people in Texas bought from people who happened to be in Louisiana, and then do the vice versa, and then compare those two numbers. And probably those numbers weren't exactly equal down to the penny, right? Just statistically, why would they be exactly equal? There's no reason to expect that. And so, in fact, I would be stunned if they were ever equal. Taking any two countries in a given year, it would be wildly implausible that they would happen to exactly balance each other. And so one of them would be running a trade deficit with the other, and the other would be running a trade surplus with the first one. And so then, suppose it turned out that Texas is running a trade deficit with Louisiana. Would the governor of Texas then say, oh my gosh, this is hurting Texas employment. We better erect trade barriers and put a tax in place on goods coming from Louisiana. Otherwise, we're going to lose all our jobs. Or, even more silly, otherwise all of our money is going to disappear. It's going to end up in the hands of, you know, Louisianans. Is that what you call people from Louisiana? I don't even know. Right? That would be crazy to think like that. All right. So, because again, that's once you understand what that term is, what the trade deficit is, you're just saying, well, all it is looking at individual transactions. So, I mean, if one person in Texas wants to buy, I don't know, a used book from someone who lives in Louisiana and he does it over eBay, well, assuming that transaction gets picked up in the statistics, that contributes towards Texas's trade deficit. Uh-oh, somebody in Texas spent $20 buying a book from somebody who happens to live in Louisiana. So other things equal, Texas's trade deficit with Louisiana just went up by $20. And the point is, nobody's hurt by that one transaction. The guy in Texas benefited, right? He thought that book was more valuable to him, gave him more utility. He preferred it to the $20 bill that he had. So he voluntarily engaged in the transaction. And the guy in Louisiana thought the other way around. He valued that $20 bill more than the book he was holding. And so that's why they made the voluntary transaction. They both walked away thinking they got the more valuable thing, and yet we just bumped up Texas's trade deficit with Louisiana by $20. And the point is, so what? Who cares? On an individual level, who cares? And then all the trade deficit is officially is adding up those transactions for everybody who happens to live in this imaginary geographical boundary of one group of people versus this other group. And if you can see why calculating the trade balance between any two individuals is kind of silly, it doesn't all of a sudden become meaningful when you do it with a bunch of individuals and just add up all the numbers. Okay, so that's one way of seeing it. Now, let's walk through it a little bit more, because I want to make sure you understand what is and is not true about trade balances, because some of you are probably jumping to the wrong conclusion. Okay, so I was a bit flippant there, and I was saying how the people in the state of Texas would not worry about running a trade deficit with the people in Louisiana. They wouldn't care. Now, probably many of you, if you think about it, would realize, well, because that's probably because Texas presumably is simultaneously running trade surpluses with other regions. And that's right. So that's one reason that any particular trade deficit is neither good nor bad, because there could be counterbalancing ones with respect to other groups of people on planet Earth. However, it is possible for a group of people to be running a trade deficit even with the rest of humanity put together. Okay, so don't think that, oh, it's got to be the case if you look at the whole rest of the world, it would all balance out. That's not true. Okay, so let's switch to the United States. It'll be easier for you to think of it that way. So yes, the United States has a trade deficit with China. And one of the ways to get people to see that number in and of itself is kind of meaningless, well, not meaningless, but is no guide for us to be worried or to be elated, is because we could point out that, well, the U.S. also has a trade surplus with some countries. I think New Zealand is one of them. Right, I looked this stuff up a while ago when I was doing my politically incorrect guide to capitalism. Right, so there are some countries on Earth where in any given year, the United States collectively sell more stuff to that people in that country than the people in that country sell in goods and services to people who live in the United States. So from the people in that country, if their newspapers might say, trade deficit with U.S. grows 10% last year, you know, government officials worried, just like we worry about the trade deficit with China or with Japan. Right, so that's one aspect of it. However, it is true that the United States runs a trade deficit with the rest of the world put together. So again, what I'm trying to get you to see is, even though you can have trade deficits and trade surpluses, and that partially explains why focusing on just one of them is kind of silly, don't then conclude that, oh, it must be the case that they all wash out. They don't have to all wash out. It is possible for people, for Americans collectively, to import more than they export. And the same thing for people who live in any other country. Just like it's possible for the people in the country to export more than they import in a given year. And so you could have a net trade surplus even with respect to the rest of the world put together. So let me just give you one little bit more to not leave you hanging. You might be wondering, well, how is that possible? Well, it's because you can obtain assets. So you can ship your goods to another country, and they would send you not goods in exchange, but claims on their future earnings. So what happens is, you know, how is it possible in an accounting sense? How can it be that Americans can get by year after year running trade deficits with the rest of the world? Like, how is that possible? And the answer is because the United States keeps getting more and more I'm choosing my words carefully. It keeps issuing a greater amount of claims on future U.S. earnings. So it's tempting to say the U.S. keeps going deeper into debt. That does happen to be true, but they don't need to be debt claims. It could be equity. So if foreigners kept getting more and more shares of stock in U.S. corporations, then that's one way you could explain how is it that Americans keep financing a trade deficit. Okay, so think of it like this. If the people in Japan wanted to get to own a bunch of shares of Facebook, how would they pay for it? Well, one way to pay for it is to ship a bunch of cars across the ocean and say, hey, we'll give you these cars and you give us shares of Facebook. Okay, so obviously in reality they're not bartering. What's happening is they're sending money, you know, they're taking yen, going to the foreign exchange markets, turning the yen into dollars, and then telling their brokers to go, you know, and the NASDAQ where they sell, I don't even know which exchange they listed, New York Stock Exchange, I don't know where they listed it, and get shares of Facebook. And then people in the United States who happen to want to buy Japanese cars are taking dollars, and then ultimately somewhere along the supply chain, the dollars are getting converted into yen, and that's what's paying the car producers in Japan. So, I mean, money is involved in between these operations, but ultimately, one way to think about the big picture is to say, if people in the rest of the world want to get their hands on U.S. assets, like shares of stock, or if they want to buy real estate that's located in the United States, ultimately they have to pay for it somehow, and so that, you know, they can pay for it effectively by sending us more goodies than Americans have to send in return. And so that kind of balances out the whole thing. So that's how it's possible. Or they could buy bonds, which means Americans are going deeper into debt with respect to the rest of the world. So now I'm trying to just make you draw these connections so you can see why some people worry about the running of perpetual trade deficits year after year, because they're going to say, we keep promising more and more of our future earnings to pay for present consumption. right? That's the idea. So you can see why this is an issue and people worry about it. What I'm trying to say is, if you wouldn't be worried about it on an individual scale, realize that on a national scale, it's just adding up all the individual ones. So an individual household, everything I just said could be applied to an individual household. An individual household, what would it mean to run a trade deficit or surplus? Well, if I take my, you know, I live in Nashville. If I take my family to Disney World, and I spend a bunch of money on, you know, at the park and on hotels and going out to dinner and stopping at gas stations along the way if we drive there, well, my household's going to run a huge trade deficit with the state of Florida because I don't have any clients right now who live in Florida. But at the same time, so part of what I want to understand, oh, gee, am I in trouble? Well, no, because my household right now is running a huge trade surplus with the state of Tennessee. Or actually, let's say with Canada, because there's a client I have in Canada that gives me a lot of work, and I don't go to Canada very much and buy stuff there. So my individual, the Murphy household, has a big trade surplus with the country Canada. I sell them way more of my consulting services than they sell me in terms of hotel stays and, you know, gas or whatever, buying candy bars at the airport if I'm ever flying through Canada. Right, so that's partly why the Murphy household's trade deficit with Florida is irrelevant, is because the Murphy household's running trade surpluses with other places. But there's no reason that needs to wash out. It could be true in a given year that I have a trade deficit overall. And again, how is that possible? Well, if I borrowed money from my parents, let's say, or if I borrowed money from the bank and bought a house, then you would say that I, you know, was running a trade. Well, the house is a little bit different because that's an asset. If I went on a fancy cruise and borrowed money, put it on my credit card, that's a more sensible way. If I went on a fancy cruise and put it on my credit card and I didn't save anything else so that, you know, I consumed what my income was and then some, and then I, you know, went into debt with my credit card to take that trip. Well, if you did the numbers, then the Murphy household ran a trade deficit with the rest of the world that year because I bought more stuff from the rest of the world than I sold to my clients who happen to live on planet Earth. But you say, oh, does the government need to do so? Well, I mean, maybe that was a bad decision for me to make, but if I'm planning on having a really good next 10 years and I feel like taking a trip right now, I mean, I should be free to do that. You don't want government policy designed to prevent me from making voluntary transactions. So that's the kind of thing. And so if you're okay with my household doing that, then so say the country as a whole is doing it, I mean, that's just you're adding up of a household. All right. So anyway, that's the way a free market people typically approach these sorts of things. And if you want, you know, in the Q&A, if you want to push this stuff, I mean, like I said, it gets really complicated really fast. For example, Peter Schiff, I'm sure many of you know who he is. This is why I used to think he was wrong, and I used to argue with him publicly. I mean, we didn't talk in a venue, but I mean, I would write stuff, and then he would like send me emails saying, "What are you talking about?" And that was part of it, is because he used to warn about the U.S. trade deficit and said it was unsustainable, but a lot of the stuff tied in with his views was the U.S. government being the one that was going deeper into debt, and that affects these statistics because if the U.S. government is issuing massive amounts of debt and then buying goods and services, it's like Uncle Sam is one huge household that gets thrown in those trade statistics. And so, you know, even a free market person might be concerned if there are trade deficits that are being fueled because this coercive institution is running up a huge tab that ultimately, you know, your kids are going to be taxed to pay down. You know, that's kind of a different thing from what we've been talking about so far in this class. So like I said, this stuff gets really complicated really fast, but I want you to at least understand the basics and understand why, in and of itself, a country's trade deficit with respect to some other country is kind of an irrelevant statistic. Okay, so let me first of all give you the positive case for free trade. Let me just jump ahead here for a second. Okay. So what I mean is there's all kinds of arguments, and I've already gone through some of them, to get why many economists, perhaps most, believe in free trade, think that the government imposing tariffs and quotas would be a bad idea. And a lot of these arguments are really clever, but a lot of them ultimately come back to showing what's wrong with arguments to restrict trade, right? We try to show that these arguments are silly or that they blow up in your face. And so before I jump into those arguments that are more fun, let me make the positive case first. In other words, I want to hear, try to explain to you why free trade is good, whereas later in the lecture, I'm going to try to show you why protectionism is bad, if that distinction makes sense. Okay, so one obvious thing is that free trade is simply extending this idea of comparative advantage and the gains from trade that we already talked about on an individual level. It's just extending it to massive groups of individuals. Right? So if you understand the benefits of specialization, comparative advantage, and trade among individuals, remember with the example about the person, the store owner, who hires the kid to clean up the store at the end of the shift. And I went out of my way there to give a case where the store owner had the absolute advantage in both selling the clothes, the merchandise, and in cleaning up the store, that the owner was better at both tasks measured in physical terms, like to say how many minutes would it take her to either close one sale or to tidy up the store at the end of the day's work. Either way, the owner was more productive than the kid was that she was thinking about hiring. And yet, with the numbers I invented for that scenario, if you remember, it turned out that it was more profitable for her, it was efficient for her to hire the kid and have him do something that she could do more quickly, that she would do a better job at. And so you say, well, you know, how did that happen? Why was that happening? Well, it was because she was better at both things, but her relative advantage was in staying on the floor and chatting with customers and pushing them over the edge to actually make a purchase. Because she was really good at that compared to the kid, whereas, yeah, she was better than the kid at tidying up the store, but her advantage wasn't as significant. And so the point is she only had so many hours in the day. And so if she had to clean up the store, that took away time she could have devoted to pushing product on customers. And so even though the kid took longer to clean up the store, it still made sense for her to do that because it freed up some of her time that was more that was better devoted to talking to customers. So there's a similar principle when it comes to just looking at nations as a whole. And what happens is the reason, how can I put it? Okay, so a given country, it only has so many resources. It's got so many workers, so many minerals, you know, so many capital goods and so forth. So if the resources in a country are devoted to producing a certain product or service, then necessarily its output of other potential products and services has to be lower because some of the resources are now being diverted to one thing. So by importing that product, what that does is it frees up labor and other resources in the country that's doing the importing. And so it's like I say, it's analogous to the situation on the individual level. So if you can understand why the store owner benefits from hiring the kid, even though she could do his job better, by the same token, even if it's true that, let's, you know, the U.S. or, you know, Germany or France, you know, some major industrialized power, even though their workers are very productive because they're working with state-of-the-art tools and equipment, and, you know, they probably have really good, many of them have excellent training, you know, education at top-notch universities and so forth, even though they're far more productive than workers in India, let's say, it still makes sense, it's still efficient to import stuff that was made in India or import stuff that was made in factories in China, because that frees up the workers and other resources in the U.S. or in the U.K. or France or Germany or wherever to then go and make the stuff where their advantage is really big. So that's one of the ways to see the positive case for free trade. And of course, you know, there we took on the hard part. We showed why even a country that's more productive in every line benefits from trading with a country where it's less productive in every line. Clearly, the benefits of trade for a country, for the, you know, less productive country are obvious. That they're obtaining something that's made by workers that, you know, it would be far harder for that, the people in that country to make. Part of the way to see it is remember that some of the difference of comparative advantage comes from purely geographical factors, right? So if you want to, how can I put it? So for example, it would be insane for people in Alaska if they want to eat oranges to try to do it themselves. Right? I mean, technically you could do it. You could have a hot house or a greenhouse in Alaska, and you'd have to spend a bunch of money to reproduce the right conditions, but technically it's probably physically possible to grow oranges in Alaska. But they would be really expensive. It's much, much cheaper for people in Alaska to specialize in pumping crude oil, bringing that to the surface and selling that on the world market, and then using the money to buy oranges that were grown in Florida. That makes way more sense. There's more oil available and there's more oranges to go around. If the people, rather than vice versa, rather than the people in Florida trying to get all of their oil from wells in Florida, and the people in Alaska trying to get all of their fruit from fruit that was grown within the borders of Alaska, if the people in those two states did that, they would be far poorer than they are if they can trade with each other. All right, so that's part of why it makes sense. But like I said, even if it weren't for those obvious cases, because there what happens is like one has an absolute advantage in one thing and one has an absolute advantage in another. But I'm saying even if you came up with if you tried to contrive a case where you said, no, there's some country somewhere where they have no geographical advantages, the people are very unskilled, they have very little tools and equipment, blah, 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 and you're just trying to paint this really bleak picture of this country that's, you know, what the heck do they have to offer? And the point is, if trade occurs at all, then what's going to happen is the countries that are trading with them, they don't have to worry about producing whatever it is that they're importing from this really unproductive country. And so that frees up their resources to focus on other things where they have a comparative advantage. Okay. Let's move on. Okay. So now let me switch to the household analogy. To show the case for trade and the problems with mercantilism. So you know, you can imagine that there's this eccentric father and let's say he's got some kids. And what does the father say? He comes home one day and he says, you know what, kids? I'm going to draw this imaginary line around our household. And you are not allowed to trade with anybody who lives outside here, right? So giving them money, No, can't do it. You have to just trade among yourselves. Okay, so we're going to keep all the money within the household. And so he, and the kids are like, why would we do that? And he says, because look at the benefits that would do. Look at how much employment that will generate for us. You know, you, Sally, you say you have a toothache? Well, don't go, oops, I just did something wrong. Well, I can't erase that thing. I don't know what I did. You know, there's some dentist over here. No, don't give your money to that dentist. Have your brother deal with your tooth. Give your money to him. And that will provide employment for your brother. And by the same token, Jimmy, you know, you say you want, you know, something's wrong with your engine and you want to take it to the shop over here for these mechanics to go look at it. No. Have your sister look at it. She'll fix the engine. And think of the employment you're giving to her. Okay, so from now on, you know, we can trade with each other, but, you know, if you want food, well, we have a backyard. We have a garden. If you want to get some cows, if you want to get some chickens, if you, you know, you want to drink milk, you want to eat meat, sure, we can do that here. There's, you know, nothing stopping us. There's no law against that. I mean, there actually probably is, depending on where they live, but you get what I'm saying. And you want a new sweater? Well, we can make a sweater. Go on Google and figure out how to make a sweater and do it here. And any materials you want to buy, don't you dare go down to the fabric store and buy it there, because then that would be providing employment to people outside this household. That's you know, diverting money and employment away from the family into a bunch of outsiders whom, you know, we don't respect. Why would you choose some stranger over your own blood? What are you thinking? Okay, so I hope everybody would recognize that this father is insane, and if they actually try to push through this crazy policy, the people in this household are probably going to start dying. Certainly if somebody gets a serious illness, unless one of their siblings just so happens to be a medical professional trained on that particular illness, they're dead. Even if he were, he wouldn't be able to like get the antibiotics. He wouldn't be able to synthesize those in his basement using materials that just came from the boundaries of the property. Okay, so I'm doing that extreme case to get you to see the problem. Now, what if instead of it being an eccentric father, instead it were an eccentric mayor? All right, I'll put a little top hat on him. And so the mayor, he says, oh, no, that would be crazy. Clearly that household would be living in poverty. He said, no, what I'm going to do is say everybody in this city, you know, there's a line we're going to draw a boundary around our city, and you have to keep all of the commerce within this boundary. And don't trade with anyone who lives in another city. But clearly our father over there is being ridiculous. It makes sense for people of one household to be able to trade with people from another household. All I'm saying is I'm being much more reasonable. Let's keep it within the city. So that wouldn't be as bad. That probably, you know, what would happen now, the people in the city, if it's like a city of 100,000 people, probably wouldn't starve to death 3 weeks after this policy is implemented. They would still be very, very poor, but they would probably be able to survive because, you know, there'd be a big enough population to support some doctors. Depending on where the city's located, there'd probably be, you know, enough land to grow some food and so forth. But eventually, you know, stuff would break down. Like, unless they happened to be located on top of some oil deposits, pretty soon the cars would stop working because without being able to import crude oil, they wouldn't be able to make gasoline. Okay, so, like I say, depending on where they're located, eventually certain things would start falling apart and they would really, their standard of living would plummet. But at least if they had 100,000 people to work with, there would be enough specialization and trade that they could limp along at a subsistence level. Whereas, like I said, with the household, they would probably all be dead pretty soon. And then we could just keep expanding it. If a if a president or a prime minister drew the line around the entire country that had whatever 100 million inhabitants and said we're not trading with the rest of the world, that would still impose hardship, but it wouldn't be as big a hit. Okay, and then if we relax it even further and say the president or the prime minister draws an imaginary line around the citizens of the nation and says you're allowed to trade with foreigners, but we're going to interfere with it. You know, we're gonna hinder those transactions. So in other words, if you want to trade with someone from our country, you go ahead and do it at the market price. If you want to trade with someone who happens to live outside of this line I've just drawn on the map, then we're going to slap on a 10% surcharge because we want to discourage that kind of activity. Well, that wouldn't be as devastating as a complete ban, but you could see why, if you know, if everything I've said up till now, you see why those would be silly and cause poverty. Well, that wouldn't be as extreme, but it's the same principle. It would make the people poor. And so if you think through, you know, again, go back to the father analogy to really see it in stark form. Why? Because it's true. The people in that household, they would never be without work. If the people in the household were not allowed to buy products or services from anyone else except their own brothers and sisters, there would be a lot of employment opportunities. And in fact, it would be a curse. Those poor kids would have to work, you know, 15 hours a day just to avoid starvation. So they wouldn't ever have to worry about being unemployed. The problem is they would have to worry about dying. And so that, you know, it's good. I like that, this analogy, this sort of extreme analysis to just underscore why conventional arguments for tariffs and so forth are actually very dangerous, you know, if you push it to this extreme. All right, so let's focus on tariffs. So first of all, a tariff is a tax. So what happens is the government puts a tax on its people when they import from abroad. All right, so you know, there's this idea people have that a tariff is just hurting foreigners. And so, like I said, the one thing I like to point out for that, and this is what's funny, like what even right-wingers like Pat Buchanan or somebody was advocating, and I'm not putting words in his mouth, he was advocating a high protectionist wall around U.S. Manufacturing and stuff like that, you know, protect U.S. employment and to bolster U.S. industries. And so, you know, one thing I would say is that, okay, but this is ironic, the right-winger Pat Buchanan, what he's saying is the way to make America richer is for Washington to levy another tax on top of Americans. Because that's what happens with the tariff, is the U.S. government is, if we're talking about the U.S. government is saying if any American citizen wants to buy a product from abroad, then we're going to slap a tax on top of that. So whatever you're going to pay that's going to go, you know, out of the pockets of the American consumer into the pocket of the foreign company, on top of that, you have to now pay a tax to the U.S. government. So now it's true that once, you know, that new reality is imposed and then you get a new equilibrium, it's true that the foreigners are hurt as well, right? Because other things equal, what's going to happen if now Americans know that, oh, gee, if we buy Toyotas in addition to whatever we have to send overseas to the people making Toyotas, we now have to send money to Washington in the form of a tariff, a lot of people are going to switch and buy Fords or whatever just because of the higher price. And so what's going to end up happening, so what that means is the demand for Toyotas is going to go down, and so the market clearing price is going to go down. So ultimately, the people in Japan are going to get a lower price per Toyota And so in a sense, they're partly bearing the brunt of the tariff. But my point is, still, what you're saying is the way to make Americans richer is for Washington, D.C. to levy a tax on Americans. It's true that some of which will end up getting borne by the foreign companies whose products are being taxed. Another way of seeing the problem with tariffs is that it rearranges employment. And if you don't know what this slide is, I'm realizing I might be dating myself here. This is from the movie Trading Places that was a classic movie when I was growing up, but I realize many of you might not even know what that is. And so the premise is these two guys switch jobs. And so that's why I thought that would be a funny photo for a slide entitled Rearranges Employment, but I realize now if you guys are in high school or something, you probably know what I'm talking about. Okay, so what do I mean, though, about rearranges employment? That, look, in the long run, in the long run, wages adjust and everybody can get a job. Okay, so this is hard to talk about when we're in the midst of this global recession, and there's various reasons that we can talk about later if you want, later on in this course, as to why the employment situation is lagging so much. But the point is, if we had a free labor market with freely moving wages, if there's unemployment, the wage rate comes down, and that clears the market. Right, we talked about last week about how minimum wage laws create lasting unemployment. But if we have a free labor market where wages are flexible, especially if we give it time to adjust, ultimately, somebody who wants to work at the prevailing wage rate can get a job. So you don't really need tariffs to promote employment per se. What is true is that a tariff can generate employment in one sector, but it ends up shrinking it somewhere else. All right, so there's different ways of seeing this. One way is just to say, this is kind of common sense, if you believe me when I say in a free market with a free labor market, everyone can get a job eventually, just the wages in different industries and occupations have to adjust, well then, necessarily, if a tariff expands employment in one sector, then those workers are coming from somewhere else. So all it's doing is shrinking employment elsewhere. So just to give you a specific example, it is true. Let's say the U.S. government puts a big tariff on Japanese cars, that it says whatever Japanese cars would normally cost, you know, what their price would normally be, we're going to put 100% tariff on top of it. So now consumers, whatever the new market clearing price is, if it's $15,000 for this, you know, new Infiniti G35, that's probably more like $20,000, then now the U.S. government, you have to pay $20,000 to them as well and as a tax. All right, so by doing that, that's going to cause American car buyers to switch out of buying Japanese cars, and they're going to focus it more on domestic cars. So that will certainly expand employment in the U.S. auto industry. But if we were originally in the position of full employment, well, then they're just shrinking it elsewhere, and then understand, well, where would it shrink it? Well, there's different ways of seeing it, but what ends up happening is U.S. consumers are now spending more on their cars than they otherwise would have, right? Because the U.S. government just made foreign cars artificially more expensive. So Americans now, their demand for foreign cars goes down, their demand for domestic cars goes up. So now even U.S. cars are more expensive. right? That's why the U.S. auto industry is bolstered. They see their prices rise. They can now afford to hire more workers. But now that means U.S. car consumers are paying more for their car than they otherwise would have. So that means they have less money to spend on other things because cars are now more expensive. So maybe part of what they do is they go out less often to the movie theaters because the car they were going to buy is now ends up being $2,000 more expensive than they originally would have had to spend. So now everybody who buys a car this year ends up spending $2,000 less going out to dinner and going to the movie theaters and stuff. So that means the restaurant industry and the movie theater industry had to lay off workers. All right, so the tariff doesn't actually create jobs. What it does is it creates jobs in one area and destroys jobs somewhere else. And like I say, in the long run, with a free market and labor, it couldn't possibly create jobs on net. It just rearranges where they are. It distorts where they end up. Okay, another way of seeing it is that a nation pays for its imports with its exports. So before we were talking about, you know, Japan sending cars and the U.S. sending wheat. And so ultimately, that's one way of seeing it, that how is it that the U.S. can pay for all of these cars that's importing? Well, it's got to be exporting stuff. And it's true, it doesn't need to balance with the individual country. It could be that the U.S. sells wheat to some other country and then, you know, uses the money to buy cars from Japan, and then that other country ships something to Japan in return. You know, it could be like a complicated three-way thing. But the point is, in the long run, especially, a nation pays for its imports with its exports. And somebody had asked in a question, you know, is there a reason for that to ultimately balance out in the long run? Well, it gets tricky. Depends what your assumptions are. Yeah, you would tend to think that over time that, you know, one country would not be able to perpetually run a trade deficit with the rest of the world. Now, you can come up with a scenario where if the country just kept innovating and kept generating more financial wealth, that in theory it could. So, like, let's say I keep focusing on the U.S. just because that's, I'm used to doing these examples. So in the United States, let's say they start building these high-rise apartments. And every year, they just add a new layer to it, right? So, you know, this year there's 13 floors. Next year there's going to be 14 floors, then 15. And they're just going to keep doing that forever. I mean, the thing's going to go up into space eventually, but it's fine. They're just going to keep getting better and better technology. And, you know, it's the Tower of Babel, and it's fine. Well, they could then, in principle, every year sell off those new apartment units to foreign buyers and then get goods coming in, and that would be a trade deficit. And so you'd say, well, how are they paying for it? And it's because every year they would be selling off those assets. Because what's happening, I should have made that clearer before, is that that assets don't count in the trade balance. All right, so if the United States pays for its imports by selling real estate or by selling shares of Google or by shipping over treasuries, you know, debt issued by Uncle Sam, that doesn't count as an export, right? The U.S. is not exporting that stuff. An export refers to goods and technically services. Okay, so someone had said, could you perpetually run a trade deficit or does it ultimately have to balance out? I don't know how you want to get answered either way. It doesn't need to balance out if you assume the U.S. is always able to generate more assets that they can keep selling. But if you think at some point that's going to be unsustainable, then yeah, it would have to balance out. At some point, the U.S. would have to start running a trade surplus to counteract all the accumulated trade deficits. All right, so anyway, that's the sort of really anal, highbrow answer. But for our purposes, I think it's okay as a basic rule of thumb to think a nation pays for its imports with exports. With this stuff, you can always bring it back to a household level to clarify your thinking. So with a household, exports and imports, that's like saying ultimately a household pays for its purchases by selling work, you know, by earning an income. All right. A household pays for its consumption by earning an income. And there's no reason that has to balance out at any given time period. You can go into debt. Or you can run a trade surplus your working career where you're consuming less than your income year after year, and you accumulate a bunch of assets, right, because you're running a trade surplus with the rest of the world while you're working. And then when you retire, you flip and you start running a trade deficit. And you start consuming down your financial assets. Okay, so if you just, like I said, with all this stuff, just think about it in terms of an individual household and just realize that anything a household can do, the nation as a whole can do, because the nation's just adding up a bunch of households. Okay, let's move on. Okay, another way to think about this is, do blockades create jobs? So here the idea is, you know, we've got this island country, and there's a scary guy here that the U.S. doesn't like. They say, oh, he's the next Hitler. So what does the U.S. do? They put all their ships around, and they blockade them. So what does the blockade do? It prevents goods from going in. So, you know, there's a TV, and the TV's about to go in there, and then the blockade's not, can't do it. You know, or there's some oil that's going in there, and the blockade's not, can't do it. So my point here is, when countries are going to war with each other, if there's one country that's a naval power, what does it do to hurt the enemy? It surrounds it with its ships, and it prevents goods from getting in. It puts up a blockade. That's considered an act of war. But yet, if the logic of protectionism is correct, that should cause an economic miracle in the blockaded country. Now they don't have to worry about cheap foreign imports, because those silly aggressors are keeping out all those imports for them. Thanks, guys. Now we don't have to bother with our, you know, tariff enforcement. You've done the job for us. And now look at all the employment opportunities we've got on our island. We've got a booming television industry because now we can't import televisions that are made in China with cheap labor. Now our workers can make televisions. And we don't have to worry about being dependent on oil from the Middle East, because now we can't get it. Those battleships are preventing the oil from getting to us. So we can devote workers to making drills and looking for oil here, even though we don't have any. Great. It'll bolster, you know, all sorts of research and development on making gasoline out of whatever, ethanol, making fuel out of corn. Okay, so what I'm saying is, taken to its logical extreme, we see that protectionism doesn't make any sense, that it's an act of war. And Henry George had a great quote on this. He said something like, in wartime, nations do to each other what is considered to be sound economic policy in peacetime. Okay, as far as quotas, what's the difference between a quota and a tariff? So a tariff boosts the price of an import, but allows people to set the quantity. In contrast, a quota sets the quantity, and then the price adjusts to whatever it has to be. Okay, so with a, if we're just thinking about the U.S. government with respect to Japanese cars, and incidentally, for foreign students, I'm just focusing on this because in the United States, especially for me growing up, that was always the deal. It was always, we're afraid of Japanese imports, and then now it's, we're afraid of Chinese imports. And that, for some reason, probably just because there are a lot of unions in the auto sector, and so they had a lot of political clout, and so that always dominated the debate. But for whatever reason, that's why these examples always pop to my mind when I want to give an example. So if the U.S. government wants to protect domestic manufacturing from foreign imports, one way they can do it is to levy a tariff. And so I already talked about this. So they might say, you know, it's either a flat dollar amount. They could say for every car you want to import or every vehicle made in Japan or made abroad, you got to pay the U.S. government $500, a flat fee. Or it might be a percentage and say, look at what the sticker price is, and then you slap on whatever, a 40% tariff. But there's no formal limit on the quantity of cars. So, yeah, people have to pay more, so they're going to end up buying fewer units than they would have under free trade. But the point is, people can still, if they're willing to pay the higher price, the government lets as many cars flow in as people want to pay for, given that they also have to make that side payment to the government in the form of the tariff. With a quota, what the government does is it sets an actual numerical limit on the quantity. So they might just say, okay, last year U.S. citizens imported, I have no idea what, you know, 10 million Japanese vehicles. So that's too many. That's providing too much cheap competition for our fledgling automakers in the United States. So this year you're only allowed to import 7.5 million. So there, the government's not getting revenue from that. It's just saying, you know, you can import 7.5 million, but then whoop, once that 7.5 millionth car passes the border, that's it. We shut the border down. And we better not catch anybody trying to bring another car in or else we'll shoot you. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but that's the idea. So that also limits the thing. And then what happens is now, given those restrictions on the quantity, the new equilibrium price is going to end up being higher. So in principle, a tariff and a quota can be equivalent. If you knew, you know, if you set a tariff and the equilibrium price with the tariff ended up being 80% higher than it was before, and you knew that the quantity of imports was cut in half, you could achieve the exact same outcome by just imposing a quota, restricting imports to 50% of what they used to be, and then the, you know, the market price would adjust to be 80% higher. So in those broad strokes, the two are equivalent, but in practice they're actually different because, and I argue in the book that a quota scares me more than a tariff, because at least with a tariff, if it really does make sense for the to import the stuff, people can still do that, and they can import more if they want to, which is they have to pay a higher price. And the percentage there, or the dollar amount, I mean, that's a visible sign of the interference with the trade. So if the government has, you know, keeps ramping up the percentage to, you know, to 200% tariff, everybody can see, holy cow, you're making this thing 200% more expensive. But with a quota, if you don't know what the quantity would be in a free market, and they just impose that quota and let it sit there for year after year, I mean, that can get to be really onerous, and you wouldn't really know that. Because, again, the quota would just be this fixed amount, whereas, you know, if they set a 10% tariff, then trade could still keep mushrooming over time. The quantity imported could keep rising, and it's just each unit would be 10% more expensive than it otherwise would have been. But if they just fix it and say, no, you can only import 8 million cars, period, and they leave that in place, when, you know, in the absence of that quota, the imports would have been 9 million, 10 million, 11 million, 12 million over time, then that quota gets more and more severe, and it's not as obvious looking at the legislation of how much distortion it's causing. So that was the approach in the textbook where I said, if I had to choose, I would rather it be a tariff because that's more visible or transparent. That in principle, the two are equivalent from a certain point of view, but in terms of the population being made to see how damaging this thing is, I think a quota is more insidious. Okay, well, we're out of time. I think there was only one question, and I answered that. So there are a ton of arguments in the case for free trade. I've only touched on some of them here. A classic thing, if you've never read it, is Frederick Bastiat's Petition of the Candlemakers. That's probably the single most famous essay, I would say, in economics, certainly among the case for free trade, and like I say, arguably in all of economic history in terms of essay. Not the most famous, but it's not a book, it's a little essay. So if you want to see that, just Google Petition of the Candlemakers and try to make sure you're getting there. You know, don't read someone talking about it. Read the actual thing. So I would recommend you go read that if you haven't already. It's not mandatory, but it's just beautiful. It's just a great example of how one communicates the absurdity of protectionism to the general public, and Bastiat was peerless in that respect. So I didn't make that particular case in today's lecture. I gave you a bunch of different arguments, but try go reading that one if you want to see more. Okay, I got to stop here, guys. Thank you for tuning in, and I will send out details about the office hours this week tomorrow.